if this person had horses, then chances are I could probably arrange some lessons. I have loved horses since that summer at Lake Tahoe with Shawnee and that summer that we planned to work on the Dude Ranch together. I had another reason for wanting to talk to a psychologist too. That being, I wanted to tell her all about Philip and ask her professional opinion. Everything I had been through with Philip was so confusing, and I had always wanted a professional's opinion because, in my opinion, the psychiatrist he was seeing was doing nothing to really help him. And day by day, he was increasingly paranoid. Even when Philip told his psychiatrist that he was hearing voices, nothing changed. Therapy did nothing to help him, and certainly did nothing to help us, who had to live with his continued delusion. So many things confused me about Philip and things he would say. I could never believe Philip was anything but sane. He thought about each and everything he did before he did it. I felt something about him was just not right. For example, I had always had my doubts about his special ability. That is, using his black box to let others hear him speaking with his mind. He always made everything sound totally logical and explained himself in all respects. But I still had my doubts. And all his preaching about how the angels control our thoughts and how they use Satan as a tool to control our minds. I've learned that Philip has never taken responsibility for his actions, so he invented a way to explain everything away, that being his angel theory. Over time, this theory evolved into him thinking that since he could hear the angels in his mind, he figured that others should be able to hear his voice in the same manner too. After that, the creation of the black box started. The black box was a black case with a cassette recorder inside that contained recordings of such sounds as football game cheering, random static from the radio, and other various sounds from the television that he would mix down into one cassette tape that he would play and amplify through speakers in the box. He would also use plastic cups from fast food restaurants and glue them in the box to make the sound different. Then he would hook up the headphones to the box and take it with him to let others hear his ability. He used to make me sit in front of the air conditioner with headphones and one of those sound amplifiers called bionic ears and just sit there and listen to that sound for hours. He called it tuning in. He would leave me sitting in front of the air conditioner for hours, trying to condition me to hear his voice coming out of it when he returned. He said, since he could hear his voice and the angels' voices in his head, that by using an outside device, like the sound coming out of the air unit, or the big overhead lights in warehouses like Costco and Sam's Club, emitting a humming, buzzing sound, that allowed him to hear the voices coming from those things as well. I didn't know what to make of all he said. On the one hand, I couldn't just come out and say, "Hey, you're crazy. I don't hear a thing." I had enough sense to know this would not go well for me. So I tried to hear what he wanted me to hear. I really did try. I sat there, and when he came back and sat in front of me and moved his lips to the words, "Can you hear me?" I really did try to hear it. I asked him, "If the sound comes from your mind, why do I need to look at your lips?" He said that my mind needed something to visually interpret into words. For some reason, I accepted this explanation and sat there until my legs fell asleep, trying to hear anything remotely like his voice. One night, I was so tired, I thought I did hear something. He had switched from the words, "Can you hear me?" to counting, 1, 2, and 3. And I thought I heard the vague sound of him counting. He told me to hold on to that fact, that I had heard him, because in the days to come, the angels would make me doubt myself. That was the one and only time I heard him. And now I think I was just so tired, and I thought if I told him I heard him, that it would end his obsession. So I convinced myself I heard something that wasn't there. It was the same thing with all our printing for less clients, too. They heard what they thought they should hear. It was a shared delusion, I've come to learn. But my hearing him didn't end his obsession. It only seemed to make him more determined for others to hear his ability. He started to think God had given him this ability to help others, specifically those individuals that also hear voices but do bad things, such as the woman who threw her 3 children into the bay. He cited this case frequently as why we needed to get going and help these people. So that became our focus, and I did try to help him with his cause. I typed flyers and sent emails to mind control victims, as well as others he thought would champion his cause. I did all this while maintaining the printing business. When I would question Philip about why he didn't go to pastors in the area and tell them his new knowledge that he was gaining from the Bible, it always ended with some excuse as to why things had to be done in a certain order and that it wasn't time yet. Philip's mission continued right up until the day he brought us to his parole office appointment. Then everything changed. Meeting with Nancy. I wanted to see her for many different reasons, the biggest being closure. To tell her that what she and Philip did was not okay in any way. Sitting across from her in that little white room for the first time in over a year felt very familiar. I guess the feeling came from knowing her longer than I had known my own mother. But I was nervous and excited and overjoyed and thankful to see my mom for the first time. Seeing Nancy did not feel in any way like that. Seeing Nancy felt almost like nothing. I think I felt like that because there was really nothing solid between us. Our whole time together was a lie, a make-believe world that her husband created to satisfy his needs. Our relationship was built on a house of cards. One good blow, and you find the pieces scatter in the wind quite easily. Those are my feelings towards Nancy. There was really nothing solid, and there is nothing for me to hold on to now. At first, when we were separated at the Concord police station, I was consumed with guilt, and my feelings were unsure of themselves. At the meeting, she kept calling me Alyssa, and I would say, "No, my name is JC." And she looked at me, and she said she was sorry, and said it was hard for her to remember. And then she did it again, and I corrected her again. I think in total, she called me Alyssa 3 times, and in each instance, I would correct her. She said she knew in her heart that something was going to happen at the parole office that day. I said that it was time, that we couldn't have continued like we were for much longer, for the girl's sake. She asked if the girls ever think of or mention her. And at first, I didn't know what to say. I looked down and then back up at her. And she said, "They don't, do they?" with these really sad eyes. I looked back down in my lap and told her the truth. I didn't try to sugarcoat it. I said that it's not really an issue right now, but if when they get older and wish to contact her, then that is their choice. But right now, it hasn't even been an issue. I said, what she and Philip did to me confuses them, and they really need her to come clean with anything else she knows about Philip. I told her Philip is not the man he portrayed himself to be. He never was. He used his con game for his first victim, and then again on Katie Calloway, the victim he was in prison for before he kidnapped me. It's always been about what's best for him. All those times he would say the angels protected him that day that he took me from the hill, never once did he ever think that I was the one in need of protection that day. I also asked her, what was the thing that Philip would say? Something about how if I knew about something he did, I would never feel the same about him again. She looked at me at first and said, what thing? I repeated my question again, and she thought for a minute, and then looked up at me and asked if I really wanted to know what that was, and I said, yes, I do. I want to know. And she said she had caught him once, torturing an animal. And I said, was it one of my cats? And she nodded her head a few times in the affirmative and then said, no, no, it was a mouse. I caught him torturing. And I said, a mouse? She said, yes, it was a mouse. I didn't expect that answer. But all I said was, doesn't that make you wonder what else he did? How about all the times we didn't know where he was? If he could hurt a helpless animal, doesn't that make you wonder what else he was capable of? And she said yes, it did make her wonder. I'd like to believe she felt badly for me all those years, but in a way, it was always a selfish act on her part. Yes, she didn't want me to go through all that. But to turn a blind eye to what she knew he was doing to an 11-year-old girl? How could she entertain little girls in the van and videotape them doing the splits and other things, all for her husband? I guess she just convinced herself that she was doing it for love. To me, that is not love. You do not follow someone blindly as they lead you over a cliff. She said that she was scared when I walked in because she thought that I would hate her. I told her, although I do not hate her, because I do not want to pollute my body with hate, what she and Philip did to me and my family was unforgivable. That my mom suffered more than any person should have to suffer, and my sister and aunt too, and the other members of my family. She said she hoped one day that my mom would forgive her, and I said I wouldn't hold out for that. She told me to call her crazy, but she still loves Philip. I told her she needed to stop thinking of what's best for Philip, because he is going to be in jail for the rest of his life, and to start thinking about what was best for her, and if she wanted to see her brothers again and have a relationship with her family that Philip tried to separate her from. I told her to take care of herself, and I told her goodbye for the last time. I told her I would not be back, that although we didn't get to say goodbye to each other at the parole office, that this is goodbye forever. And then I stood up and I walked out. Reflection. So much has happened since that meeting. For the most part, I've been able to focus on my daily life. But in the back of my mind, I might eventually have to face Nancy again. Walking away that day confirmed my right to make my own decisions. The fate of Philip and Nancy was truly out of my hands. I realized in that moment how much I have grown when Nancy's attorney felt it necessary to challenge me to call him. The El Dorado County Sheriff's Office supported me to make my own decisions. I know I owe the Garridos nothing and can't understand why Nancy's attorney felt it necessary to ask me to support the very people who abducted me. Therapeutic healing with a twist. The days following our recovery were a time of limbo for all of us. I really didn't want a therapist. I felt I had come to terms with what happened to me, and I just didn't want to relive it. Boy, was I wrong. Once I sat down and talked to the therapist they brought in, I realized I did want someone to talk to. I responded to her authentic and down-to-earth personality. Neither she nor her colleague treated me like I was special or damaged in some way. I wasn't the main focus of the group or singled out in an odd way. Reunification was unique in the fact that it focused on getting my feet on the ground. And during the reunification work, we focused on reconnecting me to different facets of my family and dealt with the everyday practical things that I had not been accustomed to, such as getting their kids their shots and overall checkups, which we never had the opportunity to do before. The girls had never been to a doctor before. We also went to see a dentist and got our teeth checked out. All of our teeth were in pretty good shape. The only potential problems the girls had were some pits where cavities could possibly develop. But other than that, they had good, strong teeth. I think one of the main reasons for that is Philip instilled the good habit of chewing sugar-free gum from a very early age in them. He was very proud of himself for reading that in a magazine about health and knew that he wasn't going to be taking them to the dentist, so he thought of a way to make it work for himself. My teeth are in pretty good shape, too. I had a lot of dentist chair time when I was little, and I still have my original fillings. They have lasted a really long time, and it really surprised me to find that out, because I thought fillings only lasted a few years. But these have lasted more than 18. I have never been fond of the dentist. I can't say it's something I ever missed. But the dentist that they took us to was very nice, and her office was open and not closed in, like I remember my old dentist's office being. The girls had no trouble either, so their first trip to the dentist was a success. I really wanted stability, not just for the girls, but me too. It took me a while to figure out that the choice to stay in the area that we had been relocated to or to go back down south where my mom, sister, and aunt currently lived was mine to make. I had never really had that choice before, and the concept was new to me. My aunt went back to where she and my mom lived to make preparations for my return. During the time she was away, I made up my mind that I did not want to return to the Los Angeles area. I had come to love the beautiful place in which I was temporarily living. Even with the generous donations we had been receiving in the mail, we still did not have enough money to buy a home or even rent one. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children stepped in, and a house was found in the secluded part of the town in which I wanted to stay. It was a beautiful old white farmhouse. It was private, and there was plenty of room to play or walk outside without the neighbors getting curious. Unlike the first house they housed us in when the FBI and El Dorado County first brought us to the area. The only rental they could get was right in the middle of town and not very private. Rentals were hard to come by because it was Labor Day weekend. The house was also full to the brim with FBI and victim advocates. When we moved into the new farmhouse, it was much quieter. Only one FBI agent came with us. We had come to really enjoy her company, and now that she has been reassigned, we all miss her very much. She made us feel safe and protected. Living together in the farmhouse, we started to learn how to be a family. We had to get used to each other's different habits and ways of doing things. It took time and work with the reunification team. During that time, I was presented with the opportunity to sell a photo to People magazine. I was leery at first. I was still unsure about how I felt about anything. The only things that were clear to me were that my mom loved me and the girls, and that I really wanted to stay where we were. I wanted to find some permanence. The media was a constant threat. I was told that if I didn't give them a picture, then they would find a way to just take it. I was free, yet not free. For the time being, nobody except for the girls and other people with whom we had come into contact knew what I looked like. It felt like I had a ticking time bomb on my head, just waiting to go off. I wanted to do things with the girls, but I couldn't. The authorities were worried I would be recognized somehow. I was told I needed a lawyer to be a go-between with the media. They were hounding for a photo and would not give up. After many sleepless nights, I decided to sign with People magazine. I would give them one photo and a statement. The day before the shoot, I had second thoughts and decided I did not want to do the photo shoot or give a photo. I was scared. I talked to my lawyer, and he said I could not back out now, that my name would be mud in the media's eyes, and I needed to do the photo shoot. He said that everything would be fine. I said I have not signed a contract, and he said one was being drawn up and I'd have it soon. I realize now that I could have just not shown up. However, in a way, I wanted to be seen finally. I wanted everyone to know how happy I was and grateful for their support. The day of the shoot, everything seemed to go by in a flash. Security was hired and also used to take the photos of my mom, sister, and me together. My therapist has a little dog that goes to work with her frequently. When the security men showed up with my lawyer to do the shoot, they walked into the backyard and Stella promptly walked over to the one with the camera, lifted her leg, and peed on his shoe. I don't think he even noticed, but my therapist and I did. The sweet little therapy dog had never or has never done that to another person. That should have been the clue to us to pack up and go. We stuck it out, though, and the cameraman did his best to make me and my mom smile. So many things were happening, and in reality, I was happy. I just wasn't happy about the way the whole People magazine thing was going. At one point, we were down in the corral with the two horses, Velcro and Frisia. Frisia, the brown Hanoverian, kept getting in front of me and the cameraman. She kept pushing me back with her body. One shot shows me ducking underneath her, just so I can see the cameraman. Then out of the blue, I was asked if I wanted to take a photo with the girls. I replied that wasn't part of the deal. But then I didn't want rumors to start about how I am trying to hide the girls. So we posed for one together with our backs to the camera. The whole day was strange, and I was glad when it was over. When the magazine came out, I was so happy with all the genuine support from everyone, and in the end, I was glad I did it. After that, I hired a public relations person and tried to stay out of the media's prying eyes. That has not been easy for me, because I love being able to do things with the girls, and that is not always possible. The reunification specialist, Dr. Rebecca Bailey, ended up becoming my personal therapist, and my recovery is an ongoing process that we take one day at a time. The day I came to Rebecca's office to meet her horses, I was hooked. One of the first things she had us do was brush Velcro and Frisia. But it didn't turn out to be that easy, because there was a catch. We had to catch them first. Rebecca loaded us up with their halters and sent us out into their pens to go halter them. My daughters were naturals and soon had Velcro haltered and were on their way back before I could even catch up with Frisia, who had it in her mind that she didn't particularly feel like being led around by a bunch of humans that day. The faster I went, the faster she went. So I had to change my thinking. I decided to ignore her and pretend I wasn't really interested. Well, that got her attention, and soon enough, she was actually walking up to me. I felt a real victory. My tummy made a flip when I felt her nudge my hand. I thought to myself, now's my chance. I turned to her and scratched her long, sleek nose, and with the halter in my other hand, I slowly brought it up to where I thought it was supposed to be. I had never haltered a horse before, and being a tad short, I found it a bit difficult, to say the least. With me on my tiptoes, and Frisia just about done with me, I tried and tried, but couldn't figure out how to put the halter on correctly. Rebecca came over to me and asked what was going on. At first, I didn't want to give up. I wanted to do it myself and have that sense of accomplishment. I knew my window of opportunity was running out, so I asked myself, do I give in and ask for help, or let the horse get away? I learned that day that I can be a very stubborn person. Frisia had pulled away from me and was on her merry way before I had made up my mind to ask for help. I turned to Rebecca, and she, in turn, suggested I ask one of my family members for help. Since my daughters did so well with haltering their horse, I asked if they would help me with Frisia. This time, Frisia was grazing on some grass and was not paying us humans any mind. Even when I walked over with the girls, she didn't seem to mind the interruption. She just calmly stood there and let the girls pull the halter over her, and then they handed me the lead rope, and off we went together into the arena to begin something that had already begun. That session ended up being one of many that brought about several revelations about me and how I viewed the world for so many years. During my time of captivity, I couldn't imagine a day I wouldn't be there, in that place, doing the same things over and over again. I never thought about asking for help. I wonder why that is. It's hard for me to understand myself. One especially eye-opening session was when I created an obstacle in the arena, which happened to be a box made of logs, and the goal was to get the horse in the obstacle using no hands or words. At first, Velcro would not go into the box, and I felt this was a metaphor for how I was feeling, not wanting to return to my box or backyard. After about an hour of trying, just because I had a task to accomplish, and I didn't want to quit, I finally decided that I really didn't want the horse in the box after all, and announced I was satisfied with the results of the exercise. We went back to the office and processed what the exercise felt like for me. Later, when it was time to leave, it was quite a surprise to see Velcro, that horse that would not go into the box, happily sunning herself right in the middle of it. Earlier, as we processed the horse exercise, I did mention to Rebecca how much easier everything seemed and less complicated in the backyard. I was feeling a lot of pressure to make decisions, and I just wasn't used to the complications of life. Even though I didn't want my old situation back, the reality was the backyard was less complicated for me in many ways, and I needed to learn to step out gradually. In another therapy session, Rebecca brought in a big horse ball and told me that we're having a day of play. I couldn't remember the last time I played just for pleasure. In fact, I couldn't remember a day I did something just for myself. Up until recently, life was about making Philip and Nancy happy and making sure the girls had everything they needed. Rebecca told me to take the ball and just play with the horses. So with the big purple ball clutched in my outstretched hands, I entered the arena and tried to get one of the horses to play with me. I spent a good hour standing in front of Velcro, the docile black and white paint, slowly rolling the ball to find that all she did was stand there and look bored. The ball would bounce off her legs and return to me, but the play was mostly one-sided. During that time, some of my rolls to Velcro would miss her legs and go sailing past her. During one of those times, Rebecca's dog, Skye, would come barreling into the arena and run to the ball that I was running after. And she stopped it and started rolling it back to me. I thought this was more fun than rolling it to a horse that clearly was having none of my antics. So I started playing with Skye, the Black Labrador. She was a great ball player, and we soon had a real game of me throwing the ball up to her and her using her nose to send it flying back to me. During this time, Frisia, the beautiful brown Hanoverian, started to become intrigued with the concept of sky playing with the big round thing and started very slowly to drift our way. Nonchalantly at first, and then later going up to the ball herself when it would get away from either me or Sky. By the end, Frisia was actually nudging the ball herself to return it to Sky. It was an amazing sight to see the dog and horse playing ball together. But I realized something too. At first, I was uncomfortable doing something just for me, and Frisia translated that and was very standoffish. But then, as I got more and more out of myself and in the moment, I began to see how important it was for me to take moments just for myself and enjoy the simple pleasures of simply playing. One horse exercise involving my family was early in the reunification process. It was a time of great confusion and just plain not knowing what was really going to happen to us. The paparazzi were a constant threat, and I had no idea how to handle any of it. Rebecca came up with this exercise to give us a real glimpse of what we were up against. My daughters wanted to stop hiding and just live a normal life. They had had enough of hiding and just didn't understand how relentless the media could be. The horse exercise started out with all of us receiving buckets. Rebecca warned us that the horses are used to the buckets containing grain. So to be careful, because once the horses see the buckets, they are going to go after them, even if there isn't any grain. In this way, they were like the media. Once the media sees you have information or a story, they come after you, even if you don't want to share, or even if you really don't have any grain or info. So we all go into the arena with our bright yellow buckets. My sister and my mom went in first, followed by the girls and then me. I was very reluctant because Rebecca pulled me aside and said she was going to fill my bucket with grain. I didn't want the grain or the story. I wanted to pass it to somebody else. But who? I couldn't pawn it off on my family. So I entered the arena with the bucket filled with grain or info. At first, I tried hiding behind my sister with my bucket, and it worked. I was left alone. The horses were busy sniffing in all the other buckets. They didn't notice me. I thought this was very appropriate because I don't get noticed anyway. Then my sister stepped aside because the horses were really starting to crowd us, and I was spotted, and the frenzy began. They knew I was the one with the story, or grain. They came at me like they had never seen grain before, and in that moment, everyone got to see the sheer force the media could be, and we knew we needed to find some help. Rebecca suggested I share and spread the grain or info out among my other family members, and then try to keep it away from the horses as long as possible. To me, the metaphor was, how long can you keep your info to yourself before the National Enquirer comes around and wants it at all costs? It was hard to keep it away from them. I am something they want very badly. My daughter felt like she could handle the media, and Rebecca told her to come with her. They walked a little ways away from the group, and she whispered something in her ear. Later, I found out she was preparing her and telling her what she had planned and how to do it safely. She put more grain in G's bucket and told her to run away with the info or grain. Well, she did, and those horses went thundering after her. It happened too quickly for me to panic, but I had a first-hand glance of just how dangerous running away with the story can be. Later, we went back to the office to discuss what had happened and how we could better deal with the situation. Contact was made with public relations expert Nancy Seltzer, and thanks to her, we have much better dealings with the media. Another component to the reunification process is food. Food can be a real comfort, and I must admit, I have used it as a crutch many times in the past. Mint chocolate is one of my favorite treats. Rebecca's team includes a professional chef, Charles. In one of the tabloid magazines, they speculated on what I fed the girls for dinner. TV dinners became their guess. Boy, did they get it wrong. We, in fact, were enjoying some delicious and nutritious meals. I feel it is super important to sit down as family every night and have dinner together. This is not something we got to do before in the backyard. Now I feel it is doubly important to instill family dinner time in the girls while they are still living at home. Hopefully, one day they will pass this new tradition of ours to their own families. Besides Chef Charles, my mom is an excellent cook as well and makes most of our meals at home. One of my favorite dishes my mom and grandma used to make me when I was little was tomato dumplings. Now that I am home, she's able to make them for me once again. It's a very simple recipe, but one that brings back such happy memories for me. Tomato dumplings. One large can, 32 ounces, tomatoes. One small can, 16 ounces, diced tomatoes. Two or three cans of biscuits. Heat the big can and the smaller can of tomato juice. You have to cut up the tomatoes in the large can into pieces and bring to a boil. Pinch the raw biscuits into thirds and drop them into the boiling tomatoes and cook until the biscuits puff up, maybe about 5 minutes or so. That's it. So easy, but oh so delicious. I'm hoping my mom will write a cookbook to pass the recipes along. My favorite thing to do in the kitchen is bake. My aunt has taught me the secret of making scrumptious chocolate chip cookies. It's basically the recipe on the back of the chocolate chips with a few tweaks, such as adding a pinch of nutmeg and cinnamon to the dry ingredients. The real secret is to mix them by hand and not with a mixer. Also, don't overmix. The cookies end up coming out of the oven softer. The first days reunited with my family were a blur. I do remember distinctly encountering some strange food in the refrigerator. In particular, some awful organic peanut butter in the refrigerator, and it didn't occur to me to ask where it came from. Later, I found it had been stocked by transitioning family chef. The chef told me later how difficult it had been to stock a kitchen with food that would be comforting to a family he didn't know. We had lived primarily on fast food, which was a challenge for my vegetarian child. The healthy food we ate was inconsistently provided in the backyard. During the reunification process, the chef began to provide us with a new definition of comfort food. In particular, I remember a satisfying morsel of chocolate filled with lemon. In the past, comfort food meant half a chocolate cake and the agony that followed. Each day, when we went to reunification therapy, we were greeted with fresh scones, cucumber water, and incredible, indescribable oatmeal. We began to suspect we were being nurtured through this healthy food. Often, after some stressful therapy sessions, we would all sit down to a delicious home-cooked meal. This time allowed us the space to connect together and the opportunity to regroup. Throughout the process, eating meals together was when we really began to feel like a family. The food often gave us something neutral to talk about. Vegetables we have never heard of were presented with regularity. Foods like fennel, Jerusalem artichokes, golden polenta, and Comté cheese became not only new words in our vocabulary, but staples in our diet. The food distracted and entertained us, allowing us to leave ourselves for a bit. Later, I heard that the food receipts were being commented on from El Dorado to Washington, D.C. They all wanted to know what was for lunch. During some of the sessions, Chef Charles would take the kids into the kitchen for baking and prepping for lunch. The kids were finding it difficult to figure out where they fit in, as my mom, sister, and I were reconnecting. That step needed to occur before we could really figure out how we all fit in together. The kids relished having a place where they could be useful and learn something new at the same time. The kids and I had already spent a good deal of time in family equine therapy, and I felt it was only right they had a break. Chef Charles recently mentioned that on one particular day, the girls helped him take down an old corral fence. He innocently mentioned how much they enjoyed that activity. I can't help but wonder about the symbolism of taking down a fence for them. It is refreshing that the chef never speculated. My growth has not been an overnight phenomenon. Nonetheless, it has slowly but surely come about. In the beginning, everything I had been led to believe from Philip was about protecting him and his plans. I thought he loved me and the girls. I have come to see his love as not real and only based in his reality when it suited him to love us. But love is not part-time, and it's not conditional. I learned this from Mom. Philip is narcissistic and only does things that benefit him. And I've come to realize this has been the case all along. I've learned when I could and couldn't push. For every argument we had, whether it be about the angels or God or Nancy or the girls, whatever it might be, I was always the one to give up and hand in the towel. I remember one time I was working on pruning my roses around my tent, and he comes to the back to announce that one of our Printing for Less clients was going to set him up with an attorney to get parole off his back. This was not the first time he said something, and then nothing happened. So my reaction was less than what he felt like it should be, and he asked why I wasn't jumping up and down. Wasn't I happy that finally we could get going? Well, yes, I would have been if I thought he was really going to follow through. But this was 2006, and up until then, he had several ideas and not one he followed through on. So inside, I was not impressed with his declaration. He became very angry and said that there was nothing he could do for me if I wasn't going to be happy. The rest of the day was awful. He moped around mostly sleeping. He told the girls, Alyssa was responsible for my mood. She was letting the angels control her. That's all part of the way I was manipulated. If I didn't do something right, it was my entire fault for how the rest of the day went. I didn't let those days happen very often, at least not on purpose. But I never really knew what could set him off. Sometimes he would shut the business down for days and wouldn't let me touch the printers or get any jobs done. Even when it would look like I had won a battle, he would act disappointed in me or just shut down for days. It taught me that most days were not worth fighting over. Some of the topics of discussion were centered around his belief that the angels existed and controlled our minds. Every bad thing humans do is due to the angels infecting our minds. When I would ask for him to clarify, It would turn into a long speech about how the angels are men and that they live under the earth, and one day he would work with the governments to uncover them. He said they gave him terrible dreams of men raping him in prison and him driving off cliffs. I thought maybe that was his conscience speaking. I always felt with him that there was no other answer but his. He would say we could ask him anything. But can you really ask anything to someone who believes that they have an answer for everything and that that answer is the right one? When it came to the Bible, he would say there is not just one answer, but that he could take one answer and make it into something entirely new. Sometimes I know my daughters don't understand why I didn't stand up for myself. It frustrates them, I know. That is something I am working on in therapy. My assertiveness. Sometimes I feel if I disagree with someone, then I need to have a good reason for doing so, and I need to have reasons to back me up. I learned in therapy the word no is a complete sentence. I love that. I never thought of that before. I'm the type of person that when something new comes up, I like to think it through. And yes, sometimes I hope the problem will just disappear or solve itself. But given enough time, I will work up the courage inside to deal with whatever needs attention. I can come up with a solution that works for me and usually works for everyone. It's hard to know what will be a mistake and what will not. With Philip, it was easier to know because I had learned his moods throughout the many years of knowing him. I learned to avoid certain situations that I knew would cause a problem. I notice, now that I have to deal with things on my own, that I avoid making certain decisions or find the easy way out. In some ways, I learned to rely on Philip and Nancy for so many things that now that it is time to do things for myself, I find it is not so easy. In my therapy, the horses gave me another example. Sometimes it is my job to catch and halter a horse. This particular horse is sometimes mean and nasty. She's the dominant female of the herd for sure, and she knows it. So when she senses that I am not a dominant female, her instinct is to challenge, or more likely, not give a flying leap what I want. So on my first try, I walk out into her stall, and she immediately rushes away from me. I have the idea. Maybe if she doesn't see the halter, I will have better luck. I put the halter behind my back, and she actually lets me approach her. Her ears are flat down, and she moves her head, like to say, "I'm going to bite you." My goal is to learn to control my fears and not show any fear. In a contradictory way, I'm afraid. But then again, I'm not afraid. I confuse myself sometimes. I know this horse, and I know she is bluffing. At least, I hope so. I try to put the halter on, but she just puts her butt to me and walks away. I have used grain before, so I go get some grain. That does the trick. She comes walking to me for the grain, at which time I slip the lead rope around her neck and wait until she finishes the grain to put the halter on. I slip on the halter and at first don't understand why I can't get the clip on. I think I must have gotten the wrong halter. But I don't want to get the other one because now I have her. I can't let her go, or I will have to catch her again. I yell for some help. Something I wouldn't have done before. Luckily, Rebecca is nearby and brings me another halter. I slip the new lead rope around her neck and drop the other in the feeder. I get the halter on and go to buckle it, only to find this one does not fit either. Darn! This must not be the right one either. But I think that couldn't be right, because Rebecca gave me the halter, and surely she knows which one to use. After several tries of unsuccessfully trying to get the buckle on, I ask a stable boy for help, He is at first confused too, and takes the halter off to inspect it. Exactly what I should have done. He discovers that it is inside out. He right side ends it and slips it back on and does the buckle up. Rebecca asks what made me think I couldn't have figured it out for myself. It got me to think what I would have done if there was nobody there to ask. Would I have figured that out for myself? I'm so used to having someone do it for me that I don't know the answer to that. All I can do is do better next time. Going out by myself is getting easier. I still prefer company, but I've learned that when forced to do something or go somewhere by myself, I do fine and feel good about myself for going. Part of my therapy includes learning as much about Philip and Nancy and the control they had over me as I can stand. This helps me to come to terms about how confusing life was in the backyard. The more knowledge I gain, the more like an adult I feel. I never got the chance to become an adult. Thanks to Philip, I missed out on some parts of normal human development, and I feel I am making up for lost time. Experiencing things for the first time, like going out shopping by myself, or even just filling up a tank of gas alone, was intimidating at first. I was so afraid I would do something wrong and then get into trouble. But since I'm not in Philip's environment anymore, I have the confidence to tell myself, it's okay to make a mistake, or yes, you can do this. I even find myself not realizing that I can do a certain thing, like go to a concert with a friend or walk into a place by myself. Sometimes I still feel like I have to have someone with me. Those feelings are slowly fading away now, and I'm doing more and more for myself. One of my favorite things about therapy is the long walks that I go on with Rebecca. I find myself talking more in those two-hour hikes than I ever would in an office. I'm not sure why this is. One theory I have is that I was cooped up for so many years that I relish the thought of walking for long periods of time and just being outside. I love being outside, whether it's for a run or just sitting and watching my cats play. It's where I prefer to be. My least favorite thing to do is sit in the office and talk. But my therapist has found a way to make it interesting for me. I love metaphors, and she has come up with the idea of lighting candles to symbolize my past, present, and future. My past and present were the two candles we started with. She would ask me what I would like to start with or deal with today. I would light up either my past or present, depending on my answer. During the last few sessions we've used the candles, I've noticed my past melting more and more and becoming duller and duller in light. To me, a lover of imagery, this is my past, slowly extinguishing itself, becoming something that's been melted, shifting and changing into something completely different than the way I saw it when it was first lit. Remarkably, my present candle has stayed pretty much exactly the way it was when we first lighted it, which to me symbolizes continuity. My future candle is a special one. Rebecca gave it to me for my 30th birthday. It is the face of a horse and her baby. From the first time I lit it to this day, it has burned brighter than the other two put together. I haven't really thought about what that means entirely, other than the obvious, that my future is bright and can contain anything I can possibly imagine. When I imagine that future, I see myself helping families heal after traumatic situations. Families are like snowflakes. They come in many shapes and sizes, and no two are the same. And like a snowflake, they are very delicate and must be protected and guarded from elements that threaten to destroy their precarious balance. When two or more snowflakes merge, they strengthen their chances of surviving in an ever-changing world. Unlike snowflakes, given the right tools, families can survive through the worst conditions. What Philip and Nancy forced us to pretend in the backyard was not a family. Yet by some remarkable fortune, the girls and I do have a bond that kept us together despite our challenging situation. Now that bond is free to grow in an environment of better conditions. Sometimes I look at my life and what I have, and I think I don't deserve it. Look at all I have when there are so many struggling just to get by and feed their families. The Jace Foundation evolved from a deep need to give back all that I was given. A pine cone was my last grip on freedom. So to me, they represent what was stolen away from me. Now that I am free, they symbolize life and freedom. They are the seeds of a new life, and that is exactly what I have. New life. The pine cone is my reminder that life can always be restarted. But I know I can't heal the world. To me, the best place to at least start the healing process is within our own families. Given the right tools, even a family that has been torn apart by unimaginable circumstances can learn to build a new path together. The Jace Foundation will be set up to support families willing to come together in a variety of situations and diverse circumstances. My hope is to provide counseling and housing for families and victims of abductions and exploitations during the crucial early days of reconnection. I will work to provide the same type of safe environment my family and I experienced during the early days. It was the simple, real approach that helped us heal and return to each other. Transitioning families worked with my family in the crucial beginning months, reuniting us after 18 very long years apart. My goal is to help one family at a time, providing the tools and time they need to thrive. Animal rescue has always been a dream of mine, and I find it ironic that I landed in a place that embodies so many of my dreams. I am hoping to rescue many needy families and animals in the years to come. I hope to encourage others to reach out and help other families and animals too. It's the simple things that count. The letters of the Jace Foundation stand for Just Ask Yourself to Care, JAYC. Acknowledgements. There are so many people I want to thank. First and foremost, I want to thank my mom. Mom, you are the bravest person I know and the ultimate survivor. If I was ever to harbor any hate in my heart, it would be for all that you have suffered because of Philip and Nancy Garrido. Mom, you never gave up hope that I would one day come home. And here I am, so glad to be back. You are everything I remember and more. You have embraced your grandchildren in a way I never believed possible. They truly have a grandmother that loves them unconditionally. I can't thank you enough for all the love and acceptance you have given us. Thank you for supporting me in all the decisions I have made. As a single mother, you have always been my hero. I knew in my heart, when I stared at the moon, that you were still holding on to hope. That hope somehow helped me get by. I encourage those of you that have had a son or daughter kidnapped to hold on to your hope for as long as you can. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was there in the background, helping my mom hold on to her hope. Since my return, this organization has been invaluable to me and my family and many others throughout the years. I thank them from the bottom of my heart. To my sister Shayna, what can I say? I have missed so many years with you, and I'm now aware of all that you must have sacrificed. While I was captive in the backyard, you were there caring for our mom. You grew up watching our mom shed tears for a sister you hardly remembered. That must have been so confusing. We should have been growing up together. Instead, we lost the innocence of our childhoods. I don't want to give one more moment to the Garridos. It's time to look towards the future and celebrate happy moments to come. I know when I returned, your life was turned upside down again. Thank you for all the love you gave us during that transition. When you taught me to drive, you gave me the first real sense of freedom I had had in 18 years. Thank you, sis. I love you. To my Aunt Tina, you are a pillar of strength. When I returned, you were still the grounded, loving aunt I remember. It did not surprise me at all that you had supported my mom and sister while I was missing. You were so wonderful when I returned. Sitting with you as mom braided my hair, I was reminded of my childhood. The missing years were behind me, and I remembered all the wonderful things we did together. Now, watching you being an aunt to my children brings happy tears to my eyes. I love you, and thank you for being the wonderful person you are. To my extended family, thank you for giving me the space and consideration to relearn who I am. You have all allowed me the time I needed to explore this new world. I am not the person today I once was, but as each day goes by, it is clear who I am becoming. My distance from all of you is more about my own personal journey and not meant to be a reflection on my love for all of you. To those of you who took part in the effort to locate me, and to those who were there when I was recovered, I want to thank you for your strength and support. In the early days of my recovery, the cards and donations gave me hope that the outside world was not such a terrible place. The money helped me believe my daughters and I would be able to survive and I would have a way, at least for the time being, to get by. We had left the backyard with nothing, if you don't include the hermit crabs. Each and every letter was a testament that it was okay to be free. To El Dorado County officials, I want to thank you for your continued support and your willingness to understand the complexity of our situation and to treat it with such care. To Trish Keller, who had the foresight to connect with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, who then were able to connect us to transitioning families. Those simple calls provided me a soft place to land and get my bearings. The community I landed in was full of supportive, loving people who provided the anonymity I needed. Not one person I encountered felt the need to expose our whereabouts. Even when federal cars clogged the driveways, making us hard not to notice. All the officials in the know, from the local sheriff's department to the FBI, practiced discretion and helped keep us safe. I want to thank Vern Pearson and staff. Throughout this journey, Vern Pearson and his staff supported me and kept me informed of the criminal proceedings with the Garridos. Vern was always willing to work closely with the mental health team, supporting my family. His willingness to keep in contact with me and my team allowed me to feel important and a part of something which had very much affected my life. Team JC grew as time went on. I want to thank each and every one of you that became part of the team. To all the therapists, thanks for making therapy something we look forward to. Each of you has brought us so much insight into our lives. To Rebecca and Jane, you have taught me friendships are more than just about agreeing. People can disagree and still like each other. You have both taught me how to stand up for myself and be a strong mother to my children. To Nancy Seltzer, my public relations expert, I will keep this short and sweet. Your advice and support is invaluable, but it is our friendship that I value the most. I would have been lost without your guidance in dealing with the headless, nameless media. Your strength is inspirational, and I look forward to all we can accomplish with the Jace Foundation. And yes, I'm learning to roar a little louder. There are so many of you who sacrificed yourself and your families to the healing of my own family. I saw the commitment it took, and although none of you asked for anything, I want to thank you for your love and support. You opened your houses and hearts to me, teaching me to do the same. You all know who you are, but in case you have forgotten, thank you for Chunky Cheeses, the horseback riding, the Target shopping spree, fostering our beloved animals, the medical care, taking us to the snow, helping us grow as a family, but most of all, helping us sometimes laugh and sometimes cry as we all figured out how to do this. To the children of my new extended family, thanks for teaching my kids to play ball, introducing them to new music, embracing uniqueness. Thanks for supporting my kids as they acclimated to this new world. And yes to one of you, I will work on getting you Dwight Howard's autograph. Thanks for sharing your parents with us and letting us see that being part of a family means reaching out and helping others. And last, but certainly not least, to Dr. Rebecca Bailey. You have become my mentor, my coach, and my confidant. You never treated me as a victim, but instead embraced me as a friend. Together, we have shared hard times and joyful times, and you have taught me to find the humor in both cases. I have found we share the same philosophy, which is, it is better to laugh and cry than to just cry. Our work together has brought insight into myself, and with your help, I am growing into the adult I've always wanted to become. The words thank you do not begin to convey how much you mean to me. Your continued support and mentoring will always be a source of comfort and strength for me in the years to come.
A Stolen Life, a memoir, was written and read by J.C. Dugard. It was recorded by Blair Hardman. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Christina Zarafanidis. A Stolen Life, a memoir, was directed by Jesse Boggs and produced by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. A Stolen Life, a memoir, is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.